What's up, Hikemer fans? Silka's Josh Portner gets his new product ideas from the craziest places. Take the new strip chips, for example. These hot melt chain wax additives were inspired by the food industry, where they're trying to find a replacement for trans fats and hydrogenated oils. Turns out, they can make it a whole lot easier to wax your chain, too. In this episode, we geek out on how that product works, the nuances of wax temperatures for proper chain waxing, and talk a lot about where his ideas come from, what else he's excited about, and why his stuff costs more than everybody else's. I love talking to Josh, and I think you're going to really enjoy this one too. Please welcome Josh Portner. Hey Josh, welcome to the Bike Rumor Show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. So we're going to talk about chain wax, and in particular, the new strip chips that you have that are apparently blowing your business up. And you know, how you came up with that idea, and you know, if you want to just give people kind of the nutshell of what the strip chips are and how they work with your chain wax products, just so people know what we're talking about and why it's cool.
Yeah, so you know, I think it's been clear maybe these last few years that the future of chain lube, at least as we can see it today, is wax based, right? It's cleaner, it's faster, the parts last longer, and really the only downside to it is to move to a wax lube, whether hot melt or drip, you have to have the chain completely spotlessly clean. And so, you know, people think of wax as being a kind of a laborious, time-consuming process, but really the hard part is the stripping and cleaning of the chain, which, you know, typically was like soak overnight in mineral spirits and then do two rinses with acetone and, you know, blow it dry with an air compressor and then let it dry overnight, and then you can introduce the wax. So, you know, we've really been looking at that as the last few years as like, okay, I think that's the barrier to entry, right? For people who want to move to wax, because, you know, the waxing itself, once you're on it, it's a couple of minutes, you know, even hot wax. I mean, all my bikes are hot waxed, my commuter bike, my kids' bikes, my wife's bike. And, you know, you turn your pot on, you get the wax hot. And with quick links, it's maybe like 4 or 5 minutes a chain. And 3 minutes of that is the chain heat soaking in the wax. So, you know, it's I would say as easy as using a wet lube, but it keeps everything cleaner. Your maintenance is reduced. The time it takes to actually clean a bike is reduced. And then, you know, if you travel with your bike at all, I mean, just the cleanliness and the ability to like bump up against it, store things in the bike box with it, you know, put it in the back seat of your car, and you never get chain tattoos on things. And so, you know, a ton of benefit to it. And we just thought, wow, I think, you know, everybody who converts really appreciates it, but this cleaning process is clearly the hurdle to entry. So yeah, we've really been focused on how do we make the cleaning process as palatable as possible for people. So
yeah. And strip chips is the answer to that.
Yeah. So, you know, two years ago, we started with kind of this dual path thing. And you and I have known each other a long time. My thing in this cycling world is a lot of times like just kind of stepping back and going, okay, are we coming up with the right solution? But then really, are we asking the right question? And so, you know, we had spent a bunch of time working on what's now called the Silka chain stripper, which is a liquid that you strip the chain in. But as we started that process, I really had a moment of like, okay, well, this is a one-step chain stripping solvent or liquid, whatever you want to call it, that replaces the multiple steps. But that's the right answer to that question, but is that the right question? And, you know, if you really take it to zero and say, you know, what do people really want? Like, what's the perfect solution? It's, well, I just want to take my factory chain and throw it in the hot wax and be done. And so then you think, okay, well, what are the barriers? Okay, factory wax is a solvent and a contaminant that damages wax. Why does it do that? Well, because it's got this oil in there that breaks down the polymers in the wax and makes them soft, and then the wax doesn't last. Okay, well, are there ways to, what can we do to the oil? You know, and so you just start going. And we're super fortunate to have a really amazing relationship with Purdue University, you know, top five engineering school in the country, one of the top schools in the world. 30 minutes from here, you know, I have two PhD students that I thesis advise there, and they've got a chain friction tester. And so we've done a lot of work for a long time with them. But they also have an amazing ag school, agri-science, and an amazing material science school. And so, you know, I get my little cardboard box of stuff and roll up there with like, okay, guys, like I am not a chemist and this is not my world, but like, this chain has grease, which is an oil plus a thickener plus a friction additive plus a corrosion additive. And the thickener and the corrosion and the, you know, other, the additives are neutral to wax. They're fine. But this oil is a contaminant. And you just start kind of riffing on, how do I turn oil into wax? How do I do it chemically? How do I, it's, I think the real beauty of my job is getting to meet people who are like way, way smarter than me about a ton of things. And so, you know, either these people know or they know people who might know, and you get, all of a sudden you've got like eight PhDs in a room and they're riffing in real time. You know, like, I'm not musical, but I've always said it feels like, you know, I see people like in a jam band.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Like for me, that's my, this is like, you know, like super science nerd jam band. and I love it because, I mean, you know, there's like words being thrown out. You're like, I don't even know what that word is.
But I love it.
But I love it. Yeah. And you just start coming up with things, and then it's, you know, well, what would the materials be? What are the chemicals? What are the temperatures? You know, what's the process sensitivity? Is it, you know, in the case of strip chip, I mean, it's five distinct things, chemicals. They're all essentially like food grade or food safe additives. And they kind of stepwise, like, you put it in there, you turn the temperature up, and, you know, the first one, the word is oleogelation. It oleogelates the oil into a thick gel. And then this is part of why the temperature has to be high. Then that gel can be combined to extend its molecular length, and that makes it harder. And then once that becomes the thing that it becomes, you have another thing in there that can connect them. And so within, you know, the 10 minutes that it's, you're agitating it at 125 Celsius, the oil literally goes from an oil to a gel to a hard, what I would call a near wax. It's not literally a wax in the purest material scientist point of view, but for you and me, it's a wax. When you look at it all said and done, like, here's candle wax and here's this thing, you can't tell it apart. And sure enough, you know, through this and the chain tester there and our athlete testing, it worked. I mean, it took 2 years, right? It wasn't easy, but we figured it out. And and the response from the consumer and really the pro teams and everybody was just amazing. Like, wait a minute, I just dropped the factory chain right in there and let it, you know, agitate it off and on for 10 minutes at this high temp, let it come to a low temp, and I'm done. It's probably a 15, 20 minute process, all said and done. And there's no chemicals involved. So, you know, really a game changer for time, but particularly for our EU customers, Scandinavian customers, and our, you would say, West Coast US customers, where it's getting increasingly hard to find a lot of the chemicals historically used to strip the chain. I think it's a real game changer. You know, our chain stripper is a biodegradable product that's currently safe in all those markets. But, you know, with the ways the rules and regulations are changing every year, they're adding chemicals to the list of things that, you know, they don't want. And so I think, you know, for us, it also sort of future proofs that, you know, we say, hey, everything in here is food grade. None of these products are listed in the terms of, you know, the government requires you to list anything that's dangerous. Not a single ingredient in there is a listed ingredient.
Yeah, that's crazy. So what caught my eye when you sent the press release out about this is, you know, in addition to like what a cool concept, right, how easy this is that the idea actually came from food, which, you know, you mentioned it's all food grade, that the food industry is always looking for, or maybe the marketing arm of the food industry is always looking for a way to make foods that will not make people fat, right? Or, you know, somehow take the fat so that you don't digest it and get it through. And this seemed to be sort of the origin story for some of these ingredients, where they would modify the fats that people eat so that they're indigestible or can't be stored as fat in the body and all that. And I was really curious, like, how did you even find out about that? It sounds like Purdue, but like,
yeah,
like, you know, how was that path from going from like this, hear about this new thing that's going to change the food industry to like, yeah, let's throw that in my chain wax lube?
Yeah, I think, again, that's the benefit of like the hive mind. You know, our core kind of basic principle pitch was, I have this thing that's covered in an oil and I need to either make that oil go away or convert it into wax. And we really kind of ended up in these steps of, you know, the first person said, oh, well, I know a technology that'll turn oil into gel. And then, you know, oh, I know a technology. So you are right. The oleogelation is, I think it's been around probably since the the 80s or so. It's not commonly used in foods currently, but you think of, you know, like Crisco, right? Crisco is cottonseed oil that's been hydrogenated, right? And margarine is canola oil that's been hydrogenated.
Yeah.
And hydrogenation is they pump hydrogen through it in a reasonably controlled process, and the hydrogen stick to the long, you have the fat or the oil is this long carbon chain. And when they say saturated, that means every possible hydrogen bond now has a hydrogen. And why that's important for shelf stability in food is that if, you know, you're trying to make a Twinkie that can last to the zombie apocalypse, you know, it if your fats aren't saturated, other molecules can stick to them. And that's how it starts to go rancid and smell, right, and have all these other problems. If you fully saturate it with hydrogen, it will remain stable and nothing wants to stick to it. But of course, we now know that there's all these health issues with hydrogenated, you know, fats in terms of cholesterol. And I'm not a physiologist or a dietitian, so it's not my world, but they're trying to move away from that because it's saturated or way less healthy. So this oleogelation concept came about, and people have been working, I think it's like the most basic form of it. You see there's like those, there's products that can congeal frying oil, right? Because you don't want to pour frying oil down your sink because it can harden. And when it hardens, it essentially turns into like a soap, but it can also turn into a gel when exposed to certain acids. And so, you know, there's these products that you can sprinkle on fry oil and it'll turn it into like a soft gel. And that's typically like a citric acid or a stearic acid. So I know because we've had people, you know, showing up in our YouTube channel with like, oh yeah, you know, put fry powder on it. And like, well, actually fry powder it's a stearic acid that turns it into a gel, but it also has this, it's called perlite. It's a soft volcanic glass that's used as a binder. It's also used in abrasives. So it's like, don't put that in there because that's like,
sounds like a slurry.
That stuff is really abrasive and it's not something you want to put it into chain wax. But, you know, that's in kind of the concept of like step one of what strip chip is doing, right? It's pulling these oils into a thing and making them into a gel. And then we can have these other things that can harden now. And to me, that's what's so cool about, you know, I'm not a chemist, you know, I'm a mechanical engineer and I, you know, worn a lot of hats.
You just play one on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. but you know, these people go, oh, well, you know, if you had a molecule that was this, then we could do this to it. Like, well, okay, how do you get it to that first thing? You know, if you give me B, I can turn it into C. And like, okay, well, how do I turn A into B? Oh, well, we can do this to it. Oh, okay, well, now it's a B. Now, how do you turn it into a C? Oh, well, we do this to it. And you just kind of step down that path. And, you know, some of the stuff we tried worked and some of it didn't. And, you know, that's where the fun of it happens. You know, some of these things where people are like, oh yeah, that here's a research paper in this topic that we read. Let's try that. And you try it and you're like, oh God, it turned it back into oil. You know, so it, like anything, there's, well, at least one that we know of, but probably a handful of ways to do it right. And there's like 10,000 ways to do it wrong. And, you know, the key is to just navigate that world to get there. But yeah, I think of it as the hive mind of, you know, and that's how the agri-science people came in, where they said, oh, you know, so-and-so was working with so-and-so on trying to make a Crisco from cottonseed oil without hydrogenation. And how did you get to the right consistency? Oh, well, we did this. And, you know, and then that just sets you on a path. And of course, that person then knows people. And so, you know, I'm the guy on YouTube, I end up getting all the credit for this, but I mean, there are probably 60 people who had input and ideas and were excited to just hear the story and throw a couple ideas at us, conceptually for how to go. And then, you know, we'd come back to our lab and play around with them and let them know what the results were. So it's a really great experience.
Yeah, that's cool. So when you add the strip chips to your hot melt wax, we'll talk about the equipment that you came up with a little bit later, just from the wax lube standpoint. You said you can kind of add up to a certain number of chips to it before it gets too dilute. But you know, like what, when it changes that oil, like clearly it's the oil off the chain grease that has become a wax-like substance and the original chain wax, right? Like they're still different to some extent, mm-hmm. right? Like this. How does that change the performance benefits, the durability? Like, what do you notice different between like a pure clean wax and the wax with the strip chips that have been added and done through that cycle?
Nothing, as long as you keep it under a certain level. So the level that we're kind of allowing in our recommendation is 6 factory chains and 6 strip chips per bag of hot wax, which is 500 grams. And the math in there works out to be something like a strip chip has 6 chips, like looks like a candy bar that you break the chip off. Each of those 6 chips is 12 grams, and each of those will fully oleogelate and then harden the 5 to 5.5 grams of grease and oil that are on a factory chain. And so, you know, what the way we looked at it was, okay, you know, every time you're doing this process, you're essentially adding 18 grams of not hot wax, right, to the system. And, you know, at some point, clearly there's going to be some performance difference. And we just didn't know when that was. And we arrived at 6 because we, you know, we honestly doing it in our lab, we would push it to, you know, we went 6, then 8, then 10. And I actually thought it would probably start to break down much sooner. And when we got to 10, we're like, well, you know, without seeing any performance degradation, like, okay, let's just cut it off there. I think 6 is a very safe level for that. And then, you know, you also have to think a lot of people are rewaxing their chain without fully cleaning it first. So, you know, like if you're doing light, relatively clean road riding, you know, even I just wipe that thing down with a microfiber cloth and you toss it in the chain to rewax. And we've tested that for years. You cannot see any degradation to performance. You know, now, I mean, you throw a muddy cyclocross chain in there, you see instantly a degradation to performance. Yeah. But, you know, that really gave us kind of a safe margin of error to play with, where, you know, we can very comfortably say, like, hey, there will be zero changes in performance, you know, in terms of both friction and single application longevity. Because that's, you know, I think for, we all love to talk in performance terms, you know, this saves 3 watts or whatever. But for most people, their real definition of performance in their daily lives is that single application longevity. You know, do I get 150 miles out of it, or do I get 200 miles out of it, or do I get 50? Those are huge differences in terms of how often you're rewaxing the chain. And so, you know, we just really want to make sure that, you know, you should be getting 250 to 300 kilometers. So, you know, give or take 200 miles per hot waxing. And we really wanted to make sure that, you know, we weren't even close to that number coming down, because I think that's, again, would be a situation where hot waxing starts to feel like more work than it's worth. Whereas 200, I think that's a pretty, for all the benefits, that feels like a really safe trade-off. And then, you know, we have products like our Hot Wax X, which is also compatible with strip chip. You know, you can easily get like 700 to 800 miles per application from that product. It's a much more expensive wax because of the graphene and some of those things. But yeah, you're trading, it's like everything in life, right? It's cost and time.
Yeah. Well, time is money, right? So you mentioned at the beginning, you know, how easy it is to wax. You just turn it on, get it to the temperature, drop your chain in for a few minutes. Do you, and I think you have to agitate it with the strip chips to work it all in, but like for a normal chain waxing, like, do you have to agitate the chain, or does it just magically work its way into all the, between all the pins and rollers and plates?
You don't have to. I always recommend giving it kind of a, you know, you put it in and you think it needs about 2 to 3 minutes for the chain to come to the temperature of the wax. And so, you know, if you ever try it, if you put the chain straight in and pull it almost immediately out, it just is like you've made a candle. I mean, the thing is just covered in wax. And that's because the chain is cold. And so the wax is just sticking to the outside of it. So you want to put it in there, give it about 3-4 minutes. And then I always give it a little agitation, just because you think of all of the interior volume of a chain, all those complex little labyrinths between the metal. It's a ton of space for air to hide. And so just giving it that shake kind of articulates it a little bit and will knock any of that residual air out. So yeah, for a typical waxing, it's probably, you know, I don't know, 3 or 4 shakes, 5 seconds worth. For strip chip, it's a little bit different in that, you know, we are trying to displace a physical thing that's already in there. And so you really want some pretty consistent agitation to kind of articulate those links in a way that the stuff that's in there that's now super hot can, you know, kind of be pumped out, allowing the wax to kind of flow in behind it. And then that's the problem. You know, essentially, if you think of it, you particularly when you laterally articulate the chain, you it kind of turns into almost like a little mini pump. You know, you're kind of opening a wedge that you're then closing and wedging the other way. And so you can actually create flow across that wedge through that lateral articulation. And as we've found in our testing, I mean, even, you know, just by hand, shake here, shake there during the 10 minutes is as effective as an ultrasonic. And so, you know, so there's no need to go quite all the way to that extreme. But at the same time, if you just throw it in there and you don't touch it for the 10 minutes and you pull it, that will not get the job done.
Gotcha. Okay. For somebody who is like considering the upgrade to the Hotmail X, what's the benefit of the graphene? Like, what does the graphene do when it's combined with the wax?
So graphene's just, you know, our standard technology is tungsten. It's like 0.4 to 0.6 micron tungsten disulfide. Graphene, you have platelets that are about the same planform area. You know, if you were to look at them, like think of them like little dinner plates. If you look at them top down, they look like tungsten disulfides. But if you look at them side on, the tungsten disulfides are probably, you know, 0.1 microns and the graphenes are one atom. So there's just this massive difference in scale. And that means for like a given physical volume of the additive, you have millions of times the number of these little graphene platelets, and graphene sliding against graphene is the lowest coefficient of friction substance known to man. So it, you know, you're getting a little bit of a performance gain, but you're getting kind of a big durability longevity gain over the tungsten disulfide. You know, the downside of the graphene is that it doesn't have quite the wet weather, I would say, durability that the tungsten disulfide has. So like if you look at the zero friction data, I think for dry and dry dusty conditions, the Hot Wax X has like four or five times the longevity. I think it might be the Hot Wax single application, like all-time leader in his test. But then if you look at it for wet performance, they're about equal. And so, you know, it's, what is it, four, five times the cost to be better in that dry and dry dusty scenario. And, you know, at a certain level, you know, we've got a lot of top tier athletes and teams who are using it, but it's fractions of a watt. You know, we've made the chain so efficient with some of these technologies that, you know, we've got a chain that's 3.4, 3.5 watts. You know, from a percentage basis, it's like, oh, from 3.4 to 3, that's huge. But in reality, it's 0.4 of a watt.
Yeah, which in the grand scheme of all of the watts of everything on the bike, it's, are you going to notice?
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's been the everything's got its up and its down. It's percentage wise, it's a huge savings. In actual real savings terms, it's small, but the cost, of course, is significantly higher. But if you're, like I said, if you're riding in dry conditions, the longevity is, you know, four times. So for some people that makes it worth it, for others not, you know, totally up to you.
Yeah, cool. So along with the strip chips, you came out with your own hot melt little dish and hanger and all this. And yeah, so what was the impetus? There's something about the temperature levels versus using a crock pot that you were pretty excited about.
Yeah, so the challenge with the strip chip technology is it requires a really pretty narrow band of temperature to work. Right, because you've got this sort of like four or five step chemistry thing happening, and you need a high temperature to get the factory greases, some of which are fairly thick, to get those viscosities to drop so you can move the stuff out. So, you know, there's sort of a double, purpose to it. We found in our testing that the sweet spot was really between 120 and 130 Celsius, and so, you know, we kind of found ourselves in this weird spot where, you know, the wax that we use begins to damage around 140 to 150 Celsius. So we're getting pretty close to that. And then, you know, your typical waxing temperature where you want to wax a chain and pull it so that you want to pull it closer to its congealing or hardening point so that it doesn't all run out. So you want to actually do the waxing and then pull the chain closer to like 75 Celsius. And so, you know, your standard crock pot brand crockpot has a low setting that is equal to between 90 and 100 Celsius and a high setting that can be more in the like 150 to 160 Celsius. And so, you know, we kind of found ourselves needing a strip chip temperature that was in between high and low. And really, you know, we had always taught people at the end of your waxing, turn the crockpot off and use a thermometer, watch the temperature fall, and then pull it at that 70 to 75, which is, you know, admittedly kind of a pain in the ass.
Right? Another barrier to entry, right?
and so with this, we, you know, started talking with a supplier who, you know, makes these, the company that makes our melter, it's really only like one company in the world, I think, that makes all of them. They're for depilatory, like hair removal. And so we went to them and said, hey, we've got this really kind of specific process, you know, need, and we wanted to make the pot, you know, bigger than the pot that they, you know, the liner bigger. And a lot of them come with kind of liner pots that, you know, you can replace the wax in and out. And we found that that really slows down the heat up, but also really kind of messes with the temperature control. And so they were great to work with. You know, we have our own custom formed aluminum thicker walled liner. We've got our own custom heating element that has double thermocouples. And then where I think we really succeeded in my mind, we're using what they call PID control. And your two options, your two primary options for controlling temperature in something like this would be thermostatic or PID. And thermostat, you know, is like the HVAC in your home, right? You set the temperature to 72, the air conditioner kicks on, it cools it to 71, it turns off. It watches it warm up to 73 or 74, and then it turns on again. And then, and so the air conditioner is either running at full blast or it's off. You know, your crock pot is either running at full crank, hot or off. That's how most of these things work. And that's like the least expensive way to run a temperature control loop. And with PID, you can think of it more like a rheostat almost, where you're controlling the amperage going into the heating blanket, and the thermocouples are smashed between the heating blanket and the pot. And it basically goes up to 75 or whatever your set point is, and then it limits the amperage flowing into the heater so that it's always at 75. And the reason this is so important with the 125 setting is, like, if you when we looked at thermostatic control, the 125 could overshoot into the low to mid 130s as it ramped up and then come down again. And of course, the point at which the wax begins to damage is like 140, 150. And so that just felt like way too close for right. comfort. And that's stinking hot. You know, I don't want it to get any hotter than it absolutely has to be. And so with this, you know, when you set it to 125, it pegs itself at 125 and sits there, until the wax is fully melted. And then it just maintains 125. And when you turn it down to 75, it lets itself coast down and it hits 75. So it just gives you a much tighter control on the temperature than you would have through other means. And I think, you know, again, it's probably not huge for most people, but, you know, any process variability you can take out is just, especially as you go down the road of this process over, it just keeps it simpler and it makes problems easier to diagnose if they happen. You know, like, oh, I did this and I got a really weird outcome. You know, if you're using this pot, you can essentially, because the pot has live temperature reading on it, you know, if it said 75, it's 75, you know, whereas if you call me and we're trying to troubleshoot wax with your crock pot that you bought at Goodwill, it's like, God only knows, you know, do you have a thermometer, you know, and we do this all the time with people, you know, do you have a thermometer or, you know, do you want to buy one? And, you know, it's not the end of the world, but it's all of that detracts from the easy factor of just, you know, the vision here, which is you take the thing out of the box, you set it up, you turn it on, you put your chain in, you're done.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Is it, so how long does it take to, once you turn it to low, to cool back down to that temperature?
It's 10 to 12 minutes.
Okay.
Depending on your ambient. Yeah. So it's, you want to, it sits at 125 for 10, then you push it, you know, again, agitating, you drop it down to the 75, and yeah, it's typically between 10 and 12, depending on what temperature it is in the room. And then you pull it and hang it, turn the pot off, and you're done.
Very cool. It's exciting. Yeah, I was going to ask you about, you know, if it needed like that oscillation or vibration or anything, but you already answered that it does not. So that's pretty cool. I love interviewing you because it's, you just love talking about your stuff. So I don't have to ask a ton of questions because you answer them all in advance, really. It's fantastic. Man. So yeah, what else do you want to talk about? We're only at like 30 minutes. We got some time.
Oh, geez. I don't know. What do you want to talk about?
Well, we were talking about something at Taipei, but what was funny about the Taipei show recently was that you and your associate literally decided to, I forget the phrase, but kick jet lag out the door and
we punched jet lag in the face.
That's it.
That's my style.
You were there for 2 days.
Yeah.
Which I think you probably spent as much time or more traveling than actually on the ground there. I was pretty tired too, so I forget exactly what we talked about, but as always, it was fascinating. I feel like it was about pumps and the manufacturing process of pumps and tolerances.
Oh gosh, I don't remember that, but I'm happy to go there.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I always find it fascinating. You know, the one thing that sticks in my mind from the last time I actually like formally interviewed you that you were talking about this Silkus pumps was that you use a leather plunger in the floor pumps anyway. Mm-hmm. And I've always wondered why. I think you have patents on that, but why nobody else did anything like that, or also why you don't offer leather plungers for an upgrade kit for any pump, because there's probably millions more pumps out there than Silka pumps. So it seems like a huge market for somebody to very easily upgrade a pump. But what are either with the chain lubes or the pumps or something, like what is kind of a manufacturing difficulty or a design difficulty that nobody else considers that you guys had to figure out the hard way?
I think in a lot of these, I'll start with when we launched the strip chip, someone in the bike roomer comments. I always love, you know, I handle most of my, like my own YouTube comments and I always love the bike roomer comments. And occasionally we'll get picked up by Pink Bike and then I can go over there. The Pink Bike comments are just like wild. You know,
it astounds me how many comments they have, but I think off the rails pretty quick too.
Oh yeah. Every time. But you know, it's like, pour yourself a drink and you know, like let's sit down. But it was funny. Somebody said like, you know, Portner, you know, acts like he comes up with all this stuff new, but he just like takes solutions from other industries and like, you know, whatever, brings them into the bike industry. And I got in there and I'm like, oh my God, you have nailed it. Like,
yeah,
like
well
I think
done.
You think you're insulting me, but that is like, yes, I will happily admit that, you know, there are very few problems and no one of us is as smart as like all of us, right? Or is as smart as the hive mind of people that you can pull together in a project. And there's so many of these things that these rabbit holes that I go to, you know, again, we've known each other forever. You know, I am a total rabbit hole guy. You know, it's like this lubricant thing. I mean, it's like 4 years ago, I kind of fell into this rabbit hole on this technology based on this research paper that I'd read. And then, you know, again, that's part of people send me, I probably get 3 or 4 research papers a week. That people, oh, I bet you'd be interested in this, you know? And I love, I mean, that's most nights I'm in bed to like, you know, 11:30 reading people's thesis papers or some published research or some new, you know, I really do love that stuff. And so I fall in these, you know, these rabbit holes and it's so much of it is like, oh, wow, how could we deploy this in our sport? And, you know, what could that look like? And, you know, I will say time and again, the limiting factor that you come to when you really put it all together is cost. And I think that comes to the other thing that everybody in the comments, especially the bike rumor and Pink Bike comments always is like, oh my God, it's so expensive. But a lot of this stuff really is like, we know the solution. I mean, a lot of these lubrication solutions we're bringing now are, they're not brand new. They're relatively new. You know, like Synergetic is the number one wet lube ever tested at zero friction cycling, right? And we tell you what's in it, right? It's a type 5 lube, which narrows it to a couple of products that uses this ultra tiny, like near nanoscale tungsten disulfide additive. There's another thing in there that we don't tell people about. Anybody can buy it and reverse engineer it, but it's expensive. And so people say, well, it's $25 for that little bottle. And you're like, well, yeah, that's because it costs like 5 times more to make than the other stuff, right? So it's, you know, I think there's this weird irony of like, our stuff is expensive, but it probably, when you, you know, if you want to come in and like really look at our books, we're probably less profitable than, you know, like the White Lightnings and Finish Lines of the world, you know, because that's a lot of that stuff is like 1960s technology that we just keep selling because it has a name and it has a momentum and it sells. But you know, the Type 5 oils, I mean, they're not new like last year. I mean, they're new like 15 years ago, but I think we're the only product in all of cycling using this oil. You know
what
I mean?
What is, like, what's the Type 5 oil versus what?
Yeah. So you think of oils essentially have had generations, like, you know, Type 1 is like your most base, you know, mineral oil out of the earth, right? Or whatever. And somebody's going to call me out on this because maybe that's vegetable oils, whatever. But the Type 2, I'll tell you, the thing for us that matters is, you know, like your standard, like automotive cheap engine oil is Type 3. And there's a ton of oils within that, but that's kind of the generation. And then your first true synthetics, you know, and we're of an age to remember like when Mobil 1 came out and they're like, this is synthetic motor oil. And it was twice the price. That's a Type 4. You know, and then we all, as a society, got screwed. Interesting story, because Castrol invented this product called Syntec, which is a Type 3 oil that they hydrocrack, which is kind of like the reverse of the hydrogenation of vegetable oil we talked about earlier. Yeah. They basically break a hydrogen off of it and they go, look at this thing we made. It's synthetic because we made it. And so it's a Type 3 oil that's now able to be labeled synthetic. And Mobil 1 and them actually got this huge multi-year lawsuit over this because, you know, Mobil 1 was like twice the cost of the Syntec stuff. And Mobil 1 lost that Castrol could call that synthetic. And so to this day, the Mobil 1 product you buy at the auto parts store is a hydrocracked, half-assed synthetic oil. And you have to go to like a race shop or know what you're looking for to get a true Type 4 oil. Hmm. And so, you know, in the last, I don't know, 15 years, again, I'm totally off the cuff. So people who really know this, this is where, like, there are people who really, like, this is their life and they, you know, they know it way deeper than me. But, you know, whatever, 15 years ago, we found, like, this next generation of oil called Type 5. It's used in a lot of places and it's just expensive because it's relatively new tech and it's not being made, you know, it's not being made in these massive, massive quantities. And so, you know, you look at the wet lubricants in cycling and they're all Type 3 and maybe a few of them are the Type 4 stuff.
What differentiates and makes a Type 5 better?
Oh, it's lower friction, essentially. Okay. I mean, I think it's more, the way it's always described to me is it's more of a tailorable molecule to get the thing that you want, right? So it's a more tailorable molecule for the features that you're after, right? And so you can tweak it in ways to bring out behaviors that you're looking for. In our case, it's low friction and the ability to really adhere to the metal because you don't want it displacing. And then you've got what they call film strength, which is, you know, in an ideal world, the oil has a film strength high enough that it doesn't let the two adjacent metal things touch each other. You know, you think of theoretically all of the movement at like the pin and roller side of the chain, theoretically that should all be rolling contact. You know, it's not, we think of it as slipping and it oftentimes becomes slipping. But in a perfect world, those things are rolling against each other because, you know, the pin is slightly smaller than the bore that it's in. And when it rolls, it builds a wedge of that lubricant in front of it. Hmm. And it's able to sort of like hydroplane on that wedge. This is one of the reasons that the wax lubricants are so good is that, you know, oil lubricants, they will do this when they're perfectly new and clean and everything else. And then you just contaminate them a little bit or get a little bit of breakdown. And all of a sudden you start getting these little like slip and then stick slip sort of things within the articulations. And that's where the wear and things start, the friction and the wear start to go up. Wax, because it's hard and it's stuck to the metal, just takes a lot longer to break down in that way. The flip side of that, of course, being that the oil-based lubes have essentially like a viscoelastic damping effect in the interface between the metal that silences noise. And so oil-based lubes will remain quiet well after you have a problem. And that's one of the reasons people tend to think wax lubes break down sooner is that you can hear them earlier. And when you look at the data, they generally last longer, but the user thinks they're breaking down sooner. And so that's one of the things we've been working to educate people on you know, here lately is people say, oh, my oil, but, you know, 1,000 miles in between re-lubrication. You're like, just because it's silent or relatively quiet.
And you replace the chain.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man. So is that that's the next phase is some acoustic damping for wax lubes?
We've thought about it. You know, the challenge is you can make it last. You can make it last a little bit longer and make it quieter if you make it a little bit sticky. But then you have all of these huge technical problems with making it sticky and that now stuff wants to stick to it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's where you have to just have to get a little bit careful, right? How much of this is, how much of this is real and how much, you know, like you don't want people to think it lasts longer only to find out that their chain's worn out at 1,000 miles when they go to, you know, re-wax it.
Right.
But anyway, but back to, as always, I get way off topic because I like to talk about this stuff, but you know, these are examples of like problems that have essentially been solved in other industries and we can bring them into cycling. And the only cost to that really is that they're not cheap.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, we tell you what this stuff is made from, you know, go to the internet and look it up. Like it's bloody expensive. And, you know, and that's just the cost of it. And my viewpoint on that is, you know, there are 1,000 companies out there right now, all making the same stuff from the same factories, or relatively, like, God knows, like our industry does not need another company doing that.
Yeah. We don't need more cheap lube of much of anything.
Or cheap pumps or cheap. And so your original question started with the leather gasket and, you know, the O-ring that's in most pumps is a penny and that leather gasket is a couple of dollars. That's the real difference.
Right.
You know, I honestly, at some level think the other difference too is, and people bring this up all the time, you know, they say, well, Silca pumps are a bad business model. You sell a pump and it lasts for 25 years. And you're like, yeah, that's why we make other stuff. Because, I mean, it's truly like, it is a pretty crappy business model, right? If I sell you something that will last 25 years and is rebuildable.
That's why you need the consumables, right? Like chain wax.
Yeah, that's why I need to sell you other things. And
so you, at the very beginning of this, you made a little comment. I don't know if you realized it or meant anything by it, but it was, you were talking about chain lubes or something to the effect of the best that we have for now. And it made me think that you're probably already thinking about what's the next, right? Like, so what's got you excited right now? What are you researching or getting research papers on that's got you staying up late at night?
Oh man, that I can't tell you with any specificity, but in the lubricant category, there is some stuff happening. I guess to paint it as broadly as possible, you think of like where we are in sort of a aerospace, auto racing, space advancements, right? Our limitations right now are materials. And I mean that from, you know, hard materials, you know, things like strength to weight ratios, strength to stiffness, temperature is probably the biggest one. That's not a big issue in our world, but for, you know, material science in general, it's like, can we make this thing lighter and handle more temperature? Because those are the limitations to faster air travel and some of the space stuff that people are trying to do. So you've got the sort of material advancements, and then you've got these like friction and lubrication is a huge thing right now. So you think of, you know, what's limiting race car engines and, you know, fuel pump assemblies inside of rocket engines and things like that. I mean, like, lubrication is a huge, huge issue. And these small tweaks can really make for big performance gains. And so, you know, I probably read, I don't know, 3 to 4 papers a week from those fields, just looking at who's doing what, you know, and some of it just, you know, a big aviation geek. And so some of it's just stuff like that, that piques my interest, you know, or, you know, I think one of the most exciting things for aviation geeks at the moment is, you know, the RAM, the radar absorbing coating that they put on the F-22s and F-35s. You know, there's been a couple of generations of that. And the problem with it is you every time you fly the plane, you're doing endless maintenance on these coatings and they break down and, you know, you go supersonic for a little bit and you start to get heat thermal breakdown on the leading edges of everything. And there's been a lot of advancements in the last probably year in terms of like discovering some ceramic-based ones and things like that. And so, you know, at the moment, what does that mean for us in cycling? It means nothing. but you know, every one of these things eventually finds a way into being meaningful for us somewhere else. And, you know, there's a ton of stuff right now happening in metal powder for 3D printing, in terms of new alloys. You know, like right now we do have some aluminum 3D printable alloys, but they have big problems in terms of getting them into production products. You know, they don't anodize well. So you've got to come up with, you know, coatings that can prevent corrosion and stress corrosion cracking and all of these things. And so, you know, we really stay on top of that as much as possible. And I love reading about that stuff. And then, you know, I think I tell all my students and my employees, my engineers, but, you know, my favorite thing about what I do is like, you can read this paper about this thing and find, you know, the author or authors, and you just call them or you find them at their university and you email them. And I don't know if I've ever had somebody like refuse to talk to me, or, you know, I've probably had a few people never get back. But, you know, 99 out of 100 times you can go talk to the person who is like the world leading expert in this topic.
Yeah.
And they will talk to you on the phone for an hour with way more excitement than I'm talking to you. And partly they're just thrilled that somebody wants to, you know, wants to learn and chat.
Or thrilled that somebody read their paper, right?
Yeah, it's awesome, right? And so, I mean, and it goes both ways. You know, I get to be like, oh man, I am totally talking to the world's leading expert in X. And that person, yeah, is like, wow, you're interested in my work.
And you tell your wife at, you know, dinner and she's like, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Yeah. Your kids are like, whatever, yeah. Dad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Like, okay. but no, it's, you know, to me, that's what's exciting. You know, I constantly just trying to stay ahead of it and read that stuff and then reach out to folks and just see, you know, and ask them questions like you just asked me. So where do you think this is going? You know, what's the time horizon? You know, is this 2 years? Is it 5 years? And so I kind of always have just this big running list of technologies and materials and things that are feel like they're coming.
I know you said some people or a lot of people just send you this stuff randomly, but like, how do you find it? Do you just have a bunch of Google alerts set up for different topics or?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Google alerts, because so many of them get published, and then I do belong to some of the, there's a couple of like Elsevier and I can't think of the LexisNexis, like their subscriptions that you can get in. And yeah, you can like flag for topics and things like that. And so it'll kick things out based on words, keywords. And then the other and the true beauty of academia, and it is such a pain in the ass. And it was funny, you mentioned like my wife, she actually like publishes and writes all sorts of like medical stuff. And so, and so she like gets it, but not gets it. But, her most hated thing, right, is like the bibliography at the end, you know, the pages of all the stuff that you reference. But I will say for, you know, someone like me who gets to show up and like pretend to live in these worlds for short periods of time, those bibliographies at the end are gold because you know, they're just telling you the name of the paper and the author of all of this other stuff. And so, you know, there's certain technologies and certain papers that I flagged where, you know, I probably have four or five authors and I just have them flagged like, hey, if they're publishing, I want to know, okay. You know, and yeah, so you're getting the alerts and, you know, it's good bedtime reading. I mean,
I will not lie. Like, when do you have time to do all this? Cause you're constantly slammed.
Oh, I mean, I will not lie though. Like some nights this like is what helps me fall asleep. and there are absolutely, I mean, it's, I really love when, you know, I'm like kind of like sitting there in bed and I'm just like, oh my God, I can't process this. You know, like my brain is like, I don't know what they're saying. And, you know, I'll go back to that one, like at a, you know, set myself like a meeting at, you know, 10 a.m. the next morning and then just go sit in the conference room by myself and work through it. But yeah, it's gold. It's gold. And, you know, I think too, the other thing I love about that is almost all of that basic science is we fund that, right? Like you, me, all the taxpayers, like we're funding that. And so I do think, you know, I look at that almost as a taxpayer of the U.S. Like, you know, like, ooh, this is something I, you know, I'm going to get my money's worth. Yeah.
So basically we're all helping to fund Silke research.
Exactly. Exactly.
Awesome. Cool. Well, Josh, thank you so much. That was super fun as always. And yeah, for people who want to find this stuff, I'll put links to the products that we talked about and our coverage of them in the show notes for this episode.
Awesome.
If you like this episode and have a product or tech you're curious about, head over to bikerumor.com/podcast and fill in the form to submit your idea. You'll also find links and photos for this episode there, plus a link to this and every other episode we've ever recorded. If you really like this and want more, hit subscribe on your favorite podcast player and leave us a rating and review. That's the grease that keeps our wheels spinning over here in podcast land, and it helps us keep getting amazing guests for you. You can find us on social. We're at Bike Rumor on all the things. And if you like random entrepreneurship, NFT, Web3, cycling stuff, you'll find me at Tyler Benedict on all the social channels. Thanks for listening. Until next time, keep the rubber side down.